Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
Eating purely for health is like marrying for money. It's kind of shady.
This week, we are excited to have with us via phone from the lovely city of New Orleans, the great writer Roy Blunt Jr., author of the hilarious new book, Save Room for Pie, Food Songs and Ruminations. This is not Roy's first book, of course. He's written 23 others, both fiction and nonfiction, about everything from the first woman president of the United States to what barnyard animals are thinking. He's a regular panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, a member of the infamous author's rock band Rock Bottom Remainders, whose ranks have included Stephen King, Dave Barry, and Matt Groening, and he has sung on stage with Bruce Springsteen. Roy is also a frequent guest on Prairie Home Companion and has too many other accomplishments to be included in this intro. Hopefully, we will get beyond those trivial musical and literary diversions to what's important, serious eating. Welcome to Special Sauce, Roy. Can I call you Roy, or in the Southern tradition, do I have to call you Roy Blunt Jr.?
Well, I seem to recall you have called me Roy several times before, Ed. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you. It's so great to have you on.
Yeah.
You and I have broken bread many times, all south of the Mason-Dixon line. So, first I have to congratulate you on the title of the new book. Save Room for Pie has been one of my fundamental eating tenets forever. You know, I mean, how could anyone not save room for pie?
There you go. And it really is, it works philosophically, I think. It goes kind of deep.
So let's talk about that then. What do you mean by that?
There's, like the first three French fries are really good. But after that, you don't need to eat the rest of the French fries, and you know that, but you do keep on eating them, and while you're doing it, you say to yourself, okay, just stuff your face, just get fat, this is ridiculous, you don't need it. You can go that way, which just makes you feel, get down on yourself, or you can say to yourself, let's save room for pie. Stop eating those French fries, and it gives you a little lift, whether you even wind up having any pie or not. If you go through life thinking about the pie that's ahead of you, you never feel like you're done, for one thing. It's not all over as long as you're saving room for pie.
It's really a metaphor for a way to live life.
Right. It's also just, I love pie, too, so it can actually be as literal as you want it to be, yeah.
I think you and I have even had pie together.
We probably have.
I love that French fry thing, because you're so right. It's also true of potato chips.
Exactly, yeah.
Potato chips are exactly the same, fall into exactly the same category.
Yeah, the first three are bliss, and the last 280 are an overindulgence.
Especially if you're 280, and I could get to 280, and you probably could too.
Yeah, I could. I could, if I had some, I talked to a man who was eating outdoors, eating potato chips, and somebody looked over at him and said, you're bleeding from the mouth. And it turned out that a light bulb overhead had burst and fallen down into the potato chips, and he was eating potato chips and shards of light bulb at the same time. So you know that you're not always fully in the moment when you're eating potato chips.
That's so awesome. So let's talk about the Blunt family table, which you go into some detail about in the book. You wrote, the way folks were meant to eat is the way my family ate when I was growing up in Georgia. We ate till we got tired. Then we went, woo, and leaned back and wholeheartedly expressed how much we regretted that we couldn't summon up the strength right then to eat some more.
Yeah, and it's one of my most popular pieces, in fact.
So
I go into how people used to talk about what they're eating while they're eating it, and the whole family going round and round.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. Did that really happen? I mean, what was the Blount family table like?
Yeah, I think it was sort of post-depression, you know, everybody, especially when you would go to visit relatives, and so there would be, you know, 10 or 12 family members gathered, extended family members gathered around the table, and various tensions going on, and but the food, wonderfully cooked, hearty southern food there, and everybody passing it around and urging each other to eat more and eat more and eat more. It really flew in the face of the whole notion of saving room for pie, though somehow or another we would manage to do that while eating an awful lot of, you know, fried chicken and vegetables and stuff. And in fact, I still love restaurants with family-style restaurants, you know, where you go and they have big platters and they keep replenishing the platters of various foods, and you feel like you can eat forever.
And that's and that's what literally happened in your house?
Yeah. I mean, as I say, mostly when we got together. But we were certainly encouraged to eat up and eat as much as we wanted to. And first of all, you were not supposed to, you were supposed to clean your plate so you wouldn't waste anything. And you were supposed to think about the starving Armenians if you left food behind. But also, you know, it was just good hearty food, and you wanted to eat as much as you could. And if you ate too slowly, your appetite would, you know, it would catch up with you, you would catch up with your appetite, and you wouldn't want to eat. So you had to get out ahead of your appetite.
That's right. And was your mom a good cook?
She was. Yeah, she was a good cook. She complained about it, and was, was part of her martyrdom that she had to cook so much. But yeah, she was. She cooked a lot of great. She fried chicken, and she would do beef stew with a pressure cooker that still is just chunks of beef and potatoes and carrots and onions cooked in that pressure cooker. It made this the most wonderful gravy I've ever had in my life. And so, I mean, there was certain limitations. She never used garlic, for instance. I don't think Southerners ever used, or well, in New Orleans, of course, they did, but we didn't know anything about garlic, but she was a good cook, and I went through this phase apparently as an infant of refusing to eat for several years, according to my mother, and she was just distraught because I wouldn't eat and I was going to starve to death. And
well, that would be a problem if you were your mom. You could see how she'd be worried about that.
Yeah, but the problem was that she kept after it. Finally, the family doctor told her. You know, it's sort of like when you call the fire department about a cat in your tree. The fire department always says, you never see skeletons of cats in trees. Eventually, the cat will come down, and eventually my appetite would come up, and sure enough, it did. And ever since then, I have been a trencherman.
What was the problem for those 2 years?
Well, I think I was just being pressed too hard. You know, my mother wanted me to eat for her sake, and I wanted to eat for my sake.
Got it. So Southern Foodways is the subject of a great deal of Save Room for Pie. And how would you describe Southern Foodways and culture?
Well, it's very oral, you know, a long oral tradition of talking and eating and sort of talking about the flavors of things. Not that Southerners are the only people who do that, but Southern literature, Southern humor, as part of Southern literature, is oral in the sense that it tries to capture the sounds of things on the page, and it also, Southern writing tends to enjoy rolling the sounds of words around in the writer's mouth and hopefully the reader's ears, more so than, you know, the New Yorker, the humor tends not to have a whole lot of oral inflection, whereas Mark Twain or Southern writers tend to get off on trying to capture the sound of animals and the pleasure of vowels and consonants artfully mixed for the ear.
Yeah, that's an interesting distinction because it's true that when you think of New Yorker humor, you don't actually usually imagine it being spoken.
Right. I mean, you know, traditionally Jewish humor, I think, is a lot like Southern humor in that regard. Enjoying the sounds of words and the oddity of language and the strangeness of way different cultures speak differently. But there's something, I guess it's, I was greatly influenced in my high school years by Thurber and Benchley and Perlman and all those guys. And I wrote for the New Yorker a few times, but I realized that I was more oral than the New Yorker.
What was your path to becoming a writer? Did you always know you wanted to be a writer?
I thought I was going to be a three-sport immortal, but...
and you fell three sports short.
Yeah, that's right. I may have fallen five or six sports short of that. And that didn't pan out, so I was sort of casting about. I was thinking maybe I would be a Nobel Prize-winning scientist but when I was 15, but... I had a great English teacher in the 10th grade who gave me all those New Yorker writers to read and big stack of New Yorker magazines that she had. And also she urged me to write for the school paper. And so I started writing a column in the Decatur High Scribbler in which I made fun of people more popular than myself.
Felt
good to me.
Yes, that's a great column to write in high school. You could get beat up, though. Did you have any physical altercations as a result?
Well, I think that I believe in freedom of speech, but I also believe in cleverness.
so you mean you masked the arrows?
Well, I don't mask the arrows. I don't know. Some of it was pretty blatant, I guess. But I didn't run up to people on the playground and say things to them. I wrote it in the paper. And by the time they read it and saw me next, they probably had cooled down. I don't know. But I didn't get in any fights over it. I was pretty slick, maybe. I don't know. I'll have to go back and read that stuff.
Did writing come easily to you back then, and does it now?
It came more easily back then than it does now. Yeah, I can. Once I got started thinking of myself as a writer, I can remember lying on the floor, just sort of wailing away, you know, with a pencil and paper. And doing writing stuff for school, you know. The reason my high school, my 10th grade teacher, Ann Lewis, whom I stayed friends with until she died a few years ago, I was always perversely right about something other than the assigned topic. You know, just sort of meta and write about my pencil or something. And so she thought I was a budding humorist. So sure enough... I figured, oh, well, I can do this, you know. I'll just do this the rest of my life. But, of course, it took a lot longer. I went through college where I wrote a lot about politics, during the Civil Rights Movement, wrote about politics. And I've always written about serious stuff, but I've always written humor, too, same time sometimes. I was a newspaper reporter in the, and a sports writer for quite a while. Worked for Sports Illustrated, but I was always trying to work various humorous and orally gratifying veins. Orally gratifying veins. That sounds like vampires.
Exactly. Whoa. I might have to take off my headphones. Speaking of sports, exactly. Speaking of sports, your first book was about the Pittsburgh Steelers, and it was called "About Three Bricks Shy," and the load filled. It sounds like it's kind of instantly became a classic. Dwight Garner wrote, "It isn't just a classic of American football writing, but the classic of American football writing." I mean, that's pretty high
that
praise.
About 45 years after it came out, it was very gratifying. But instant is not the term I would say. But yeah, it has stayed in print, and it gets a lot of accolades. And it was a great experience. I was working for Sports Illustrated at the time. I was on the staff there, and editor and managing editor Andre Laguerre called me into a bibulous lunch down at the Ho Ho Bar. And said he wanted somebody to spend a year with a football team and write a book. And I was divorced and sort of free and easy. So, well, not so easy, but free anyway. And I picked Pittsburgh because I had written about the Pittsburgh Pirates a lot. I loved the Pittsburgh Pirates. They were really funny in the locker room and yelled at each other and played jokes on each other. But I'd also written about the Steelers, the Rooneys, who who the family that owned the Steelers. The Pittsburgh was full of characters, sports, whether sports related or not. So
Doc Ellis
insisted on the Steelers. Yeah.
And what intrigues you about sports in general?
Now, I don't think it's nearly as much fun to write about sports because the the players are making millions and millions of dollars, which is fine for them. But they're surrounded by they have no reason to talk to people who are making $50,000. But back when I was doing it, we were all making $15,000, players and the and me. And so I don't know. You sort of felt like you're on the, in the same boat with them, or you could. And also, but anyway, players are sports are really are physical. So you can write about what people do with their hands and feet instead of more and more sports now is getting statistical and financial. So it's a lot more abstract writing about sports now. But when I wrote about it, it was, there were sticks and pigskins and latissimus dorsi, and they all mingled in a very visceral kind of way. Now I'm mixing my metaphors again, but there you go.
But what's interesting, it is interesting that you were on equal footing financially, which can't be said by very many sports, if any sports writers these days.
Right. And also, the players can talk on television. They relate more to the TV people, and they aspire to be TV people themselves later on. And so they gravitate toward the TV, where you don't really ever have to say anything very interesting, and you don't have to worry about being misquoted because.
And you're interviewed so many times that you can't help but sound bored.
Players, when I was covering sports, they were all either from the streets or the country. Almost all of them. None of them came from middle class backgrounds. But very few of them did. So they all had really colorful backgrounds and painful childhoods, and they had come up rough and school of hard knocks and all that. So they tended to be very interesting, have great backstories, and tended to be very they were cautious until they got to know you and got to know the writer. But then as soon as they got to know me, they would just tell me anything. It was just, so I had to restrain myself.
That's funny. You had to make some things they said off the record.
Yeah, that's right. I tried not to get anybody arrested or fired or divorced.
Let's talk about Save Room for Pi. How did the book come about?
I did two books for Sarah Crichton at FSG about the alphabet and about writing and words and alphabet juice and alphabetter juice, or the joy of text. So, and I was casting about for another book to do for her because I really like working with her, and I noticed that I had lots of stuff that I'd written about food over the years, and got into it and wrote some more stuff and reorganized it all and fiddled with it and turned it into this rich sort of stew of a book.
It is a rich stew of a book because there's songs and limericks and poems.
Yep.
And some longer essays, and they range from fairly serious topics to not such serious topics, and yet it holds together. Was it just organic, or did it take a great deal of organization?
It took some organization, and I left some things out, and Sarah talked me into leaving some other things out, and then talked me into putting some other things in. I don't know. I spent a year fiddling with the whole thing after it was mostly written, so it took some sort of orchestration on my part, which I enjoyed doing. Once things get written, it's kind of a relief to move them around. Writing is the hardest part, and rewriting is more of a pleasure.
So, if you had to tell me in a couple of sentences what Save Room for Pi is about, what would you say?
I'd say it's about Well, one reviewer said it was about the difference between what's real and what's not. But the harder things are to chew, the more interesting, the longer you get to taste them. So I tend to favor substantial food, and at the bottom of my list of foods is foam. I just denounce the whole notion of mushroom foam and, turning food into a chemical, It's my job to break food down after I eat it. It's not supposed to be.
Right.
So I think there's a lot of that, the anti-abstract and pro-substantial, and also consideration of, that account of the way I used to eat growing up in big family gatherings and eating as much as possible is doesn't really work today because you got to consider, you got to eat in such a way as to save the Arctic ice from melting, and you got to eat in such a way as to accord the chicken you're eating sufficient dignity in its life.
And, exactly.
And to worry about your health, all kinds of things. I think it's that eating purely for health is like marrying for money. It's kind of shady.
But
I mean, it's not crazy. There's a rationale there, but unless there's an element of yum at the beginning, I don't think it's going to work.
The book is really about it ranges pretty far and wide.
Oh, but just in terms of range, there's a long piece called Louie, Fats and Slim about the five musicians that have, according to my collection, have recorded the most songs about food. That would be Louis Jordan, Louis Prima, Louis Armstrong, Fats Waller, and Slim Gaylord.
Yes, Slim Gaylord. Dunkin' Bagels. See,
right.
You're talking to somebody who has a Slim Gaylord compilation.
Oh, good. Yeah, I do, too. And there's Slim and Slam.
Yeah.
Slim Gaylord's wonderful. And he claimed to have invented the word groovy, or the term groovy is applied to music. But I don't know whether that's true or not, but he made up lots of words, O'Rooney and Vout, but he also sang over and over and over songs about food. But Louis Armstrong is the greatest musician ever, for one thing, but he also recorded the most food songs by my count. I've lost track of how many. It's in the book how many he did. But, Rump Steak Serenade and
Big Butter and Egg Man, Struggling with some Barbecue. I mean, we could go on forever. I mean, we could go like Fats Waller, obviously, Honeysuckle Rose. You can. That was just your take on it, and it's sort of food related, but it's as music related as it is about food.
Yeah, but it's about people who great musicians who enjoyed food the way I do, and relished food, and therefore sang about it, and so I think it's the whole book is a kind of celebration of food and a holding on to the kind of gusto that I grew up eating with while trying to be responsible about the whole thing.
You may try hard these days, but back then you weren't responsible.
Well, that's what I say. Yeah, I'm trying to hold on to the early gusto
and keep the pleasure.
There's a lot in there about my marriage because my wife is very... she has led me down the path of organic, and so now I feel guilty not to eat organic stuff and grass-fed beef, not just grass-fed beef, but grass-finished beef. And it actually makes food a lot more interesting if you think about the animals involved. And there are several things in this book about how animals eat and about animals that, there's a thing about the time I swam in the Amazon River and got bitten by a piranha, so it works in different. I ate piranha, which I caught, but also a piranha actually got into my bathing suit pocket and started chewing on my leg.
Talk about payback.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Except I'm way ahead still.
Right. You're still here.
Yeah.
Obviously, music is a great passion of yours. You are a charter member of the Rock Bottom Remainders.
Yeah, but that doesn't prove anything about how musical I am.
You're not really proud of your output, I would say, because it says on your website, and I quote, over 350 million books sold, 40 New York Times number one bestsellers, one lousy band.
There you go. Yeah, if we ever It's like somebody said about James Thurber, his drawings, and said when Thurber started doing some shading and stuff, he said, no, stop that. If you ever got to be good, you'd just be mediocre. And the band is a long way from mediocre. Even.
The band is a long way. That is low praise.
Well, that's right. It's better to go. But we do have a couple of good. You know, James McBride is in the band, and he's a good musician. And Greg Isles from Mississippi is a good blues guitarist and singer.
So you have two semi-legit musicians.
Yeah, they are there. But then there are a lot of and there, you know, I would put Dave Barry in the semi-legit category, but I'm the least legit.
And what about Stephen King and Amy Tan? Are they just like they're just along for the ride?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I mean, when Steve is with us, you know, one time our bus, we were riding in one of Aretha's old buses, and we were going down the interstate somewhere, and the bus broke down, and I had to pull over into a parking area, you know, and Stephen King came out of the bus, and somebody popped up with a copy of The Stand for him to sign, as if they had been waiting there forever, just on the off chance that Stephen King might
break down in an arrest area.
There you go. Yeah. So he's a big figure, and Amy Tan is the band's rhythm
percussionist.
No, what do you call like an S&M mistress? You know, rhythm. Anyway, she wears black clothes and long boots and things.
Oh, she's a dominatrix. She's your resident dominatrix.
That's the word I was looking for. Yeah, rhythm dominatrix. She will pretend to whip the members of the band, saying these boots are made for walking.
So there must be great visuals. You know, you guys don't even need like fireworks because it sounds like there's a lot going on stage.
There is. There is. It may be more interesting visually than auditorially.
You live in New Orleans now. You've written entire books about the city. You appeared as yourself in Tremé, the TV show about New Orleans. There's a lot about New Orleans and Save Room for Pie. What does New Orleans mean to you? Why do you think it's so important as a city? And we have to talk about New Orleans food a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think New Orleans is a prime example of you know, really enjoying food and enjoying sensations and having fun and letting the good times roll and all that stuff. You know, there are not too many cities that you think of as being devoted to pleasure, but New Orleans is. In New Orleans, people in New Orleans are hearty and friendly and sometimes violent, unfortunately, but very seldom are people in New Orleans sort of dry and abstract. So it's a great great city for people who enjoy food, enjoy music and food. We were eating. There's nothing quite like a crawfish boil to bring food, you know, to register the substantiality of food.
Because yeah.
Spread a whole lot of boiled crawfish, as you know, on a newspaper on a table, and everybody just starts grabbing crawfish and breaking them open and sucking the heads and peeling the tails, and it's almost like animals.
Yeah. Now, you wrote very movingly about New Orleans post-Katrina, and I think that is where I felt how strongly you feel about New Orleans from a cultural standpoint.
Well, New Orleans, has, you know, jazz started out in New Orleans and came up the river. All kinds of things started in New Orleans. The mafia came to New Orleans before in this country. But there's always been great musicians here and just a great tradition of pursuit of pleasure. And also just a lot of resilience. I mean, the city was devastated. We have so many. We were not living in New Orleans during Katrina, but we were a frequent visitor, and now we own a house here. But so many of our friends whose houses we go to and eat in and listen to music in, they had their houses were 5 foot deep in mud, you know, and now you wouldn't know it. I mean, city came back. People were saying, why don't you just let, you know, lots of Republicans were saying, why do we need to save the city? Just let it go. But the city did get saved. All kind of new blood has come in. New young people come in, and the city is booming now. There are more, and the traditions have been revived since Katrina. The second line parades are much more frequent now than before, and there are a lot more good restaurants now than there were before. So it's a city that it's hard to kill New Orleans.
Yeah, for sure. So I'd love you to sing or read one poem or song from the book.
Okay, there's a nice quick one is Song to Pi. They don't have tunes, fortunately, because you wouldn't want to hear me sing them. But Song to Pi goes like this. Pi, oh my, nothing tastes sweet, wet, salty, and dry, all at once, so well as pie. Apple and pumpkin and mince and black bottom, I'll come to your place every day if you've got them. Pie.
And that's just one millionth of what's in the book, which is why it's so awesome. So why is it so important to save room for pie?
Well, as I say, it just is it makes you future-oriented, and it keeps you from stuffing your face too much before dessert. And if we're still saving room for pie, then we're not, everything's not over. You know, we might just wait till the next meal to have that pie, but to have the dream of pie and the real possibility of pie is a rich and manifold kind of thing to bear in mind.
So one more question before we get to the buffet, which is I read that you actually sang on stage with Bruce Springsteen.
Well, as part of the band, the Rock Bottom Remainders, and my part, we did Gloria. And the only thing I ever do in Gloria is sing G-L-O-R-I-A, Gloria, amongst lots of other people who are. So I try not to get too close to the mic when I'm singing.
I see. All right, now it is time for the special sauce, All You Can Answer Buffet. So what's in your desert island fridge, Roy?
Oh, gosh. Oh, I have a fridge on my desert
island. Yeah, you have
a
fridge. You've got electricity, you know, ice, you've got everything you need. This is a really, really well-maintained desert island.
But my favorite I'm starting with dessert, which I shouldn't be doing, but when you say refrigerator, I'm thinking of the flavor of ice cream that you get from the Varsity, my favorite, the Varsity of Atlanta, Georgia, the greatest fast food place in the world. They have a black walnut ice cream, which I haven't seen anywhere else. So I would have a tub of that and some kind of pie to put that on. I would say maybe some blackberry cobbler.
All right.
So now that's what I'm saving room for.
Right.
But I would, cold fried chicken is awfully good. Today I had lunch. Had some seafood gumbo that I got yesterday over at the French little place at the French Market over by the river. So gumbo lasts quite a while in the refrigerator, and you might even be able to replenish. You'd have to catch some fish, I guess. Crab, I love crabs, and the thing is that you could probably catch some more crabs on the desert island.
Right, that's true.
And boil them, yeah. So there's that.
All right.
But some fruit, some peaches maybe, and some blackberries, and what else is good out of the fridge, cold? I like bologna. I shouldn't eat that.
I like the way you think, because your fridge is so full, you don't even need to be rescued.
That's right. Yeah, I could just crawl up in there with it, with the food.
So who's at your Last Supper, no family allowed?
I guess, you know.
This could be aspirational, too. You know, it doesn't have to be.
I think it'd be great to have Shakespeare at the table, because it'd be great to say to Shakespeare, save room for pie.
All right.
Maybe he would write it into one of his plays.
I like that.
Let's see, Shakespeare. And I'm a big Mark Twain fan, so why not Mark Twain? And,
okay.
And wouldn't it be cool to see what Emily Dickinson was like around the table? I bet she would open up.
You think she would?
I think we could get her to open up. Shakespeare and Mark Twain and I could get her going. I bet she'd love it. And I don't know. I guess we'd want a food. MFK Fisher or somebody. I don't know. We could have you, Ed. You want to come?
Yeah, I would come. And MFK Fisher probably took herself way too seriously. You'd have a lot more fun with me at the table.
Yeah, probably. Okay. Well, we'd have, you know, you're gonna have got to have, say, Fats Waller, though. He might eat everything.
Now, I love that table. Fats Waller, Emily Dickinson, Mark Twain, Shakespeare, you and me. That is my idea of an ideal table for six. So what are you eating at the Last Supper?
Well, I'd say some gumbo, and I don't want it to be all New Orleans food. But, last night, you know, I went to this great party for a man who just got released from prison after 42 years in prison.
Wow.
And we had a table full of boiled crawfish. And the great thing about boiled crawfish is that you can all get around the long table there, and you can come and go and eat with your hands and talk, and you don't have to worry about dropping a fork or anything. So some boiled crawfish, but there was also fried chicken there last night. I don't know where it came from, but it was excellent fried chicken. And so that's good. I mean, I could, you know, get more fancy than that. But
no, why? Why would you bother to get more fancy if you are starting with fried chicken and gumbo?
All right. And in the boiled crawfish, of course, you've got some corn and some potatoes. So you got vegetables right there.
Excellent. I like the way you're thinking. And then, of course, pie for dessert.
Yeah.
So what's your guilty pleasure when, you know, because Joan sounds like she's really, really steering you in the wrong direction towards healthy, proper eating. But when she goes away, like, what do you buy?
Well, I want to go buy some, you know, I like frozen waffles.
Do you eat them frozen?
No.
Okay.
Put them in the toaster.
Okay.
Put some butter on them and some syrup. But you know, I feel guilty if I'm eating inorganic now. So it's like vaguely unfaithful. So we eat pretty healthy even when she's away.
Right. Well, thank you so much for sharing your special sauce with us, Roy Blunt Jr.
Well, thank you, Ed. I'm going to go have a bite of something right now, I think, after all that talk.
We all need a laugh these days for obvious reasons, and there are plenty of laughs to be had reading Roy's new book, Save Room for Pie, Food Songs and Chewy Ruminations. Listen to him on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and you cannot go wrong reading any of Roy's 23 other books. Thank you, Roy, so much for doing this. This was awesome.
Great. I enjoyed it very much.
And until next time, Serious Eaters.